regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program today. We're going to be talking with Costas Moros from the Second Amendment Foundation about the case that the Supreme Court agreed to hear on Monday, the case U.S. versus Hamani. This is a case dealing with Section 922G3, the same statute that Hunter Biden was prosecuted under, right? That bars unlawful users of drugs from possessing firearms. One of Hamani, by the way, one of, I think, five cases that the Supreme Court had considered in conference. A couple of them are still actually unresolved. Now, the Supreme Court has denied cert in two cases dealing with the same question, both of those cases out of the Eighth Circuit. In fact, I bring this up with Costas because I wonder if the Supreme Court isn't maybe giving us a hint as to how it might rule in the Hamani case. You've got basically a four-way circuit court split over the constitutionality of Section 922G3 with, I think, the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals just saying, yeah, the law is perfectly fine in its entirety. No reason to question it. Eighth Circuit and I believe the Third Circuit have suggested, well, there needs to be some sort of individualized finding of dangerousness before somebody can be prohibited from owning a firearm because they're an unlawful user of drugs. The Fifth Circuit has taken the position that in almost every circumstance, the law is going to be unconstitutional, that the national tradition of firearms ownership may allow for prohibitions on possessing firearms while you're intoxicated, but not barring possession of firearms for individuals who use intoxicating substances, whether or not they are legal or illegal to possess and use. So with that as a background, we also, by the way, talked with Costas about California's reply in the Duncan case. This is the challenge to California's magazine ban. The cert petition was presented to the Supreme Court several weeks ago. California has now issued its response. That happened on Monday as well. So we discussed that with Costas Moros. Take a look and a listen. Costas, thanks very much for coming on the program. It's good to see you again.
Cam, thanks for having me on. Always a pleasure.
Absolutely. And this is the first time that we've had you since you have become the Director of Legal Research and Education at the Second Amendment Foundation. Did I get the title right?
Yeah, you did. I mean, I have to check it because I don't always remember my title. Yes, I think you got it.
Well, again, congratulations on the new gig. It is fantastic that you're over at Second Amendment Foundation, but really pleased that you could join us today to talk about a couple of cases, one that was granted cert by the Supreme Court on Monday, another that hopefully will be granted cert by the Supreme Court in the weeks ahead. This case, U.S. versus Hamani, this was one of like five cases dealing with Section 922G3, right? The federal prohibition on unlawful users of drugs possessing firearms. And this was the case that the government wanted the Supreme Court to take, right? There were some other cases that just dealt with individuals who were caught possessing guns while they admitted to smoking marijuana. Mr. Hamani, much like Mr. Rahimi, is not exactly a sympathetic defendant, I think.
No, this is the probably the worst case we could have decided this issue on, because it has all sorts of strange facts, which the government plays up in the petition, even though they're ostensibly not relevant, because they're not really charging him with these other crimes that they allege. Like, he supposedly has ties to the Iranian Guard, which is a terrorist organization. He has all this sordid history, but of course they use this as the vehicle and not a number of other petitions. I know we're currently preparing an amicus brief in support of cert in another case called Harris v. United States, which is a far cleaner vehicle. And we still hope, although maybe the odds of that have now gone down because of this grant, we still hope the Supreme Court will consider both cases together so they have at least one more normal case to go along with this very strange one. Yeah.
Yeah, and this is also a case that deals with, I believe, Mr. Hamani was accused of using both cocaine and marijuana as opposed to just marijuana. But, you know, you talk about the Harris case. As I mentioned, there were four other cases, at least two of which I believe are still, the court hasn't done anything with them yet. They're still sort of hanging around. But what I find interesting, Costas, and I want to get your opinion on this, is there were two cases from the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals, Baxter and Cooper,
that the court denied. And these were, the government had requested that the Supreme Court grant cert and then hold on to these cases until after it resolved Hamani. So hopefully our audience is not getting too in the weeds for our audience, but there's some circuit court splits. The Fifth Circuit says one thing, Seventh Circuit says something else, Third Circuit says something else. The Eighth Circuit has come down basically that Section 922 G3 is constitutional, at least for some people.
Yeah.
But there needs to be an individualized finding of dangerousness, that somebody poses a danger because they are an unlawful user of drugs who possess firearms. And I thought this was really interesting. So they denied the Baxter case last week. Mr. Baxter, his case was remanded back down to the district court with that instruction, do an analysis. And the district court found that Mr. Baxter is dangerous and can't possess firearms. Mr. Cooper, on the other hand, the district court, when it did its analysis, found that the government had not proven that he was dangerous. And so they dismissed the charges against him. Now, the Supreme Court rejected both of those cases. They didn't hang on to them as the government requested. So Mr. Baxter's going to prison. Mr. Cooper's not. And I wonder, Costas, does this perhaps signal that the court is at least open to what the Eighth Circuit has said in terms of Section 922 G3? Because I find it interesting that they didn't hang on to these cases like the government had requested.
Yeah, I think the best result we can get here now, because honestly, the best result is that they wouldn't have taken this particular case. But now that they've taken it, the best result we can hope for is that the Supreme Court reaches a ruling that basically says this has to be an individualized case-to-case finding of dangerousness. Maybe they comment on marijuana specifically, because marijuana is just, it should be treated as a different category than cocaine or I think the other drug he used was called promethazine. I don't even know what that is, to be honest. But it's a controlled substance. So I think the best we can hope for is that the Supreme Court says, as applied to Mr. Hamani, this was a constitutional, it's constitutional to deny him firearm rights. However, maybe they leave open the question of marijuana for non-dangerous people, or they decide it like we're going to suggest in the Harris case, you know, if they take two together and use that as a sort of foil to Hamani and say, but as to Mr. Harris, it wouldn't be constitutional to bar him from firearms just because he sometimes smokes marijuana.
You know? Okay.
So I think that would be the ideal outcome. Unfortunately, it could also go the other way, and the Supreme Court may just rubber stamp 922 G3 and say, yep, illegal drugs are, you can ban people from guns if they use any illegal drugs, and it's up to Congress to say if marijuana is okay or not. You know, that doesn't seem to square with Bruin, but
it doesn't even seem to square with Rahimi.
Yeah, I agree.
Because Rahimi, the court suggested that that there again needs to be this finding that somebody poses a danger to themselves or others, a credible threat of danger, I think was the phrase that was used, before they can be disarmed under a domestic violence restraining order. So to me, if that's true with another 922 case, it should be the case with 922 G3, but it sounds like you're not particularly optimistic that the Supreme Court would adopt the Fifth Circuit's view that in essence, 922 G3 may be constitutional for some people, but there really is no national tradition of banning all unlawful users or all users of intoxicating substances from possessing firearms, which is where the Fifth Circuit came down.
Yeah, I think the Fifth Circuit's ruling is correct. It's just that the Fifth Circuit is falling into the same trap they did with Rahimi, which is just the facts are so bad that the court will not let it stand. You know, this is a political grant, not a constitutionally sound. And now this is not a jurisprudential grant. They're granting this because the facts are bad. Like Mr. Rahimi, the court can't stomach, I think, I hope I'm wrong, but the court can't stomach the idea of someone like him getting to basically keep the right to bear arms. So they're going to, I think, do what they need to do to make sure that doesn't happen. This is still a political institution as much as we wish otherwise. You know,
yeah.
That's the reality.
It is. I think under the Eighth Circuit test, there's a plausible argument that Mr. Hamani would be deemed dangerous. But
yeah, and that's. And, Yeah, that's my best case scenario, I think, is that we get that sort of ruling that carves it up rather than a blanket ruling on 922G3.
Yeah. All right. Well, I guess, you know, we'll see. The first briefs are due in December. Oral arguments will take place in the spring, and we'll have a decision hopefully by the end of June in the court's term here, along with Wolford versus Lopez. So which brings us to Duncan, because I was going to ask, do you think we're going to see the Supreme Court take a third or maybe even a fourth Second Amendment case this term?
I've been saying for a long time that they should do 3 to 5 cases a year for a few years to just clean up the big issues. You know, the who questions, the where questions, the what questions, just resolve all of them. And then we'll leave you guys alone. That's always been my thing. Like, give us at least the big ones and we'll work out the smaller ones. But look, realistically, the Supreme Court doing 2 Second Amendment cases this year when it's done like 4 or 5 in its whole history, you know, is pretty incredible. So that's the silver lining here. At least we're going to get, when they grant something like Mani, at least we're going to get more guidance from the Supreme Court. I just wish it was a case with better facts. Now, as to Duncan, does that mean Duncan's odds go down? I hate to say it, but probably yes. And that breaks my heart because I worked on that case and it affects me directly. I have Freedom Week mags. You know, I probably shouldn't admit that now. I hope I'm wrong. I really hope that they just take what I've been saying and just grant cert. Let's do 3 cases this year. 1 where question, 1 who question, and 1 what question, you know, just let's do them all. But after Justice Kavanaugh said in Snopes last year that they're going to decide a case in the next term or two, and he mentioned all these cases that are proceeding, they may just wait for the 3rd or 7th circuit rulings. And that's why, by the way, our amicus brief that we did for Duncan on behalf of SAF, I argued that if the Supreme Court doesn't want to hear Duncan yet, they should just hold it indefinitely. Because if they deny cert, then the magazine ban goes into effect for everyone who has Freedom Week bans, and either we'll have to get rid of them, modify them, or become felons. So in that circumstance, I really urge the court to just hold Duncan until you're ready to hear this issue, even if you hold it till next year.
Yeah.
Keep the mandate from taking effect, basically.
Well, and you know, again, I hope that they take Duncan too. But as you say, you've got the 7th Circuit cases challenging Illinois' ban on both so-called Wasoabans and large capacity magazines. The 3rd Circuit case, which again is both a gun and magazine ban, waiting in the wings, right? I mean, we heard oral arguments last week on Bonk in the 3rd Circuit. So conceivably, depending on how quickly the appellate court issues its decision, I mean, that case could be appealed to the Supreme Court, you know, at some point in 2026, right? I don't know if it'd be early enough. It'd be a stretch for it to be early enough for the court to consider it this term.
Almost certainly not this term. Because the 3rd Circuit is historically fast at issuing rulings compared to the other, not historically fast, but relatively fast compared to the other circuits. So I think oral arguments went well for us. You never know for sure until you have the ruling. We shouldn't count anything yet until it's actually done. But if I'm correct that the 3rd Circuit goes our way, then we do have our circuit split. Mm-hmm. And then the question becomes, some are hypothesizing, well, maybe New Jersey won't appeal it. You know, they'll face pressure from the other anti-gun states to just take the loss, because if they appeal it and then the Supreme Court grants cert, it'll be a national precedent. But I'm not as worried about that, because I think when it comes to magazines and assault weapons, that's the hill they will die on. There's no way New Jersey doesn't appeal that loss and just lets it happen. You know, so I think I'm less concerned about that. Bringing it back to Duncan, I do think the Supreme Court is looking at these pending cases in the 3rd and 7th Circuit, and they probably do want to hear what they have to say, especially with the possibility of a circuit split on the horizon, because they love circuit splits.
So. They do. Well, and understandably so, right? Because it makes it a little bit more of a live issue when you've got this conflict between the appellate courts. But, you know, as you say, with Duncan, if the court doesn't grant cert or just, you know, hang on to this case, at least, if this law takes effect, then the law takes effect in its entirety, right? It's not just the portion dealing with the latest revision to the magazine ban, I should say, because there are like 4 iterations of this historically, right? The entire magazine ban goes into effect, including that provision that Mr. and Mrs. California, you can't keep your 15-round, 17-round, 20-round magazines. You either have to permanently alter them so they can hold no more than 10 rounds. You've got to get them out of state. You got to turn them over to police. But you can't keep these things that you lawfully purchased and lawfully possessed.
That's correct. And that's the big change here, especially after Freedom Week, what, you know, my old colleagues at Michelin Associates got because of that injunction that lasted about a week. They got hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of mags into the state. And those have been protected for now because that's been essentially stayed enforcement of that. But if mandate issues, if the Ninth Circuit's mandate issues, which is what will happen if the Supreme Court denies cert, then everyone, I'm sure the California DOJ won't just say overnight, they'll probably give everyone 30 days, 60 days, 90 days, whatever it is. And then that's usually how they do things. And then they'll say, okay, as of this date, you either have to get them out of state, modify them to only be 10 round magazines, or turn them into police. You know, that's what it's going to be. And, you know, there is, and we argue this openly in our amicus brief for SAF. I wrote that to the Supreme Court. Look, there's a lot of people out there that know in their bones that this is unconstitutional, and they're just going to ignore the law. I'm not going to comment on if I'm one of those people, but I do know it in my bones that this law is unconstitutional. So it's time for them to stop this cowardice and just take the case. Like, even if I've said, you know, this should be a per curiam ruling. It's such a simple issue. You don't even need to do a full case. Just issue a per curiam ruling and say, no, magazines are common. They are arms. Ninth Circuit, you're wrong. You know, that's it. It doesn't need to be a drawn out argument because as we see it, this issue was decided in Heller. So.
California. So California submitted its reply brief to the Supreme Court. Was this on Monday?
Yeah, just today. Yeah.
Okay. And what do they have to say about Freedom Week? Because again, this 1 week period of time where the magazine ban was stayed. I mean, you could argue that these magazines are in common use simply based on the sheer amount of magazines that were purchased in that 1 week period of time. But as I understand it, California kind of, not just kind of, it really downplays the consumer response to Freedom Week.
It's actually very funny because when Freedom Week was happening, they made angry, literally, if you go back and read them, angry motions to to Judge Benitez and threatening to go to the Ninth Circuit, basically saying thousands and thousands of these illegal magazines are entering California. You need to stay your ruling until we appeal because we're going to be so harmed by all these magazines coming in. So they were really playing up so they could get their stay. And it was true, though, how many magazines were entering the state. Now, all of a sudden, in today's opposition to cert, they write, well, we don't really know how many of these there are. There's probably not even that many being the implication they're making. And more frustratingly, they say, and by the way, if you bought one during Freedom Week, you should have figured that this was just temporary, that these magazines were going to be illegal once again, which is just such a frustrating argument when it comes to, you know, our constitutional rights.
Yeah, absolutely. But as a California gun owner, Casas, are you used to these frustrated arguments that we're hearing from Cal DOJ? Do you ever get used to it, or does it rankle you every time?
I would say that I've never accepted it, but I am numb to it at this point. I've read it so many times. Like, I think I joked about this on another podcast recently. It's like, oh, sure, I read another brief. Yeah, Bowie knives again. Sure. You know, like, it's always the same regulations that have nothing to do. You know, you could buy Bowie knives on Amazon these days. Meanwhile, like, repeating rifles were never restricted in the 19th century. But this is the comparisons they're making to us with a straight face. At first I was angry. Now I'm just numb to it. And I hope the Supreme Court finally does its job on this.
Absolutely. And as you say, the issue really is that simple, right? I mean, when you look at the national tradition of firearms ownership in this country, 1791, the standard was single shot firearms, right? We then went to, you know, multi-shot revolvers. We then went to breech loading rifles that were, you know, much faster to reload. Then we went to lever action rifles, the you know, load on Sunday, shoot all week, as Henry Repeating Arms said. And at no point during those technological advances did we see, you know, any widespread or national tradition of banning those firearms, as we went from, again, one shot to 14, 17 shots, right? It really wasn't until when? The 1980s, right? Was that the first magazine ban? Not the
So California will argue that there were some in the 1920s and 1930s, but those were actually machine gun laws.
Okay.
And there was some weird language in some of them, but it was repealed by the 1950s because they realized the issue. So the modern magazine ban started with California, I think, in 1989 after that terrible school shooting in Stockton. I think Roberti Roos Act or whatever it was called. Mm-hmm. And since then, I think we're up to 10 or 15 states now that have similar laws. I some of them only do the assault weapons, not the magazine. So it's a little confusing, but it's still a minority, but it's a growing minority. And that's why we hope the Supreme Court addresses this.
Absolutely. Well, listen, I appreciate you coming on the program. Thank you again for all of the work that you're doing for gun owners and with the Second Amendment Foundation. And look forward to having you back again soon. Hopefully we'll get I'm going to knock on wood that we get a third, maybe even a fourth Second Amendment case, and we can have you back on to talk about the next 2A related case that the Supreme Court's going to discuss.
I would love nothing more, and I'd even forgive the Supreme Court for granting certain immunity if it was Duncan. We'll take that trade. Thanks so much for having me on.
Thanks, Costas. My thanks to Costas for joining us on the program. Looking forward to having him back again very soon. Always appreciate his insight and analysis. Right now, let's get to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report. We will start there with a case out of Cincinnati, Ohio. Accused gunman in downtown shooting was wearing an ankle monitor after weapons charge. Not the first time that this individual has faced charges of illegally carrying a firearm as a prohibited person. Cincinnati Inquirer reports that 50-year-old Robert Shaw has been charged with murder after police say he committed a drive-by shooting in downtown Cincinnati around 2 o'clock in the morning on October 17th. 34-year-old Justin Johnson was shot and killed in that incident. Shaw was wearing an ankle monitor at the time of his arrest. He had outstanding charges of carrying a concealed weapon and illegally possessing a firearm. He was released back in June. On those charges, on just a $20,000 bond with electronic monitoring, which meant he was restricted as to where he could go. The judge later modified the terms of his release to allow him to look for a job, but typically one doesn't look for employment at 2 o'clock in the morning, right? According to the Inquirer, Shaw's criminal history dates back more than 25 years to 1998, when he served 6 months in prison on a cocaine possession conviction. Since then, he has been arrested and convicted numerous times for illegally possessing a firearm, receiving stolen property, and other crimes. Police, according to the Inquirer, were able to use Shaw's ankle monitor data to identify him as a suspect in Johnson's shooting death, which I guess is maybe a one positive. But again, if this individual had been held until trial, or at least held on a higher bond, then maybe this murder wouldn't have happened at all. The Inquirer also notes that it says the use of GPS ankle monitors came under scrutiny in Cincinnati earlier this summer after police said two people wearing the devices removed them and then killed other residents. An Inquirer review found that tracking how often people tamper with and remove the devices only began recently. So, you know, again, this is something we've talked about on multiple occasions here. I don't think that everybody who's been charged with a crime should sit in jail until trial. That actually should be reserved for fairly extraordinary circumstances when somebody is known to be, or at least believed to be, a danger to themselves or others, a threat to the community, a flight risk. Under those circumstances, again, I think it's appropriate to hold those individuals until trial. But GPS monitoring devices are filled with false promises, right? Oftentimes, again, they're supposed to be tracking devices, but nobody's keeping track of where these individuals who are on GPS monitoring devices are. So they can be downtown at 2 o'clock in the morning when they're not supposed to be there. It's not like an alert goes off and police go track this person down and say, hey, why aren't you where you're supposed to be? After the fact, there may be repercussions, but it is not a cure-all for keeping criminal suspects on the straight and narrow after they've been released from jail awaiting trial. All right, on to today's Armed Citizen story from Florida. The headline, Cortez shooting case ends on stand your ground ruling. This is an odd case. I don't think the judge got it wrong. But it is a little unusual. This is from the Anna Maria Islander newspaper. A Cortez man cleared of aggravated assault with a deadly weapon charges after a judge ruled that he acted in lawful self-defense under Florida Stand Your Ground law. Case involved Kevin Armstrong, 42 years old, stemmed from a shooting last year in the Sunny Shores community of Cortez. Judge Frederick Mercurio issued a ruling earlier this month dismissing the charges against Armstrong. He was accused of firing a shotgun during an armed confrontation outside of his home. He was arrested after that altercation on June the 6th, altercation that took place with his girlfriend, Caitlin Lipke, and two other men. According to court filings, Armstrong and Lipke had had an argument. He told Lipke to leave, so she does. She meets up with two guys named Cole Banyas and Dylan Taylor. They were both armed when they later drove Lipke by golf cart to Armstrong's home to get her belongings. When they arrived, Lipke allegedly shoved Armstrong as Banyas and Taylor displayed firearms, quote, in a threatening manner, according to a Stand Your Ground motion filed on Armstrong's behalf. That is when Armstrong fired a shotgun blast into the air, quote, as a warning. At that point, Dylan Taylor is accused of firing towards the house. And in that exchange, Caitlin Lipke was struck in the chest. Armstrong was wounded in the foot. Now, according to the local paper, after reviewing testimony and evidence, Judge Mercurio found Armstrong's belief that he faced imminent danger to be, quote, reasonable under the circumstances, and granted him immunity from prosecution under the state self-defense statute. Again, you're confronted by two armed men who stand by as your girlfriend gets physically abusive with you. Maybe you do have a legitimate fear of death or great bodily injury. What is a little confusing to me, though, is that, again, warning shots aren't really a thing, legally speaking. And I'm kind of surprised that the judge actually came to this conclusion. If you have a legitimate fear of death and great bodily harm, you're not required to give somebody a warning shot. In fact, I would argue that's a bad idea. If you are truly concerned that your life is in imminent danger, you don't fire up into the air, you don't fire into the ground, you fire to stop that imminent threat to your life. And in this case, it sounds like Mr. Armstrong did not do that, that he was still hoping a shotgun blast in the air would dissuade these armed individuals from threatening him with further harm. Which, by the way, based on the account that I just mentioned, it sounds like that didn't work. That after Armstrong fired that blast into the air, Dylan Taylor then fires a shot towards the home. So, again, I don't know how this was resolved at the time. If the trio then just fled away in the golf cart, Mr. Armstrong went back inside his house, I don't know. But I do think it's reasonable to believe that, let's put it this way, I do think it's reasonable for Armstrong to have believed that there was a threat to his life and limb at that point in time. Again, I'm just kind of surprised that the judge said, yeah, so it's fine, you fired a warning shot, rather than shooting at the person who posed an imminent threat to your life. And again, just as somebody who's covered armed citizen stories for more than 20 years, I would not and cannot advocate firing a warning shot, because that can, again, lead to charges like aggravated assault with a deadly weapon or at least illegal discharge of a firearm. If your life is not in imminent danger, don't pull the trigger. If your life is in imminent danger, then you shoot to stop the threat. You don't fire a warning shot in the hopes of persuading your attacker to stop what they're doing. All right, on to today's good deed of the day. In the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. A 911 dispatcher in Lynchburg, Virginia, I ran across this story. Lynchburg is, I guess, my local news. We don't have any TV stations in Farmville, so I can pick between Charlottesville, Richmond, and Lynchburg, because I live sort of equidistant between the three communities. So I ran across this story just in my perusal of local news. Lynchburg officer committed for saving fourth life through CPR guidance over the phone. That's pretty extraordinary. I mean, there are a lot of people who will go through, and now granted, she's a 911 dispatcher, so she's dealing with, you know, life-threatening situations on a daily basis. But to be able to do this four times in her career, that's pretty amazingly, pretty amazing. Officer Samantha Mattingly, according to the Lynchburg Police Department, recently guided a caller through CPR and helped the individual regain a pulse before Lynchburg Fire Department EMS arrived there on the scene. Lynchburg PD says this is the fourth time, again, that Mattingly has saved a life through CPR guidance, saying her experience and steady professionalism have made a real impact time after time. The police department also notes that Mattingly regularly donates whole blood, plasma, and platelets with the American Red Cross, saying, quote, she has a true heart for helping others and saving lives in every way she can. LPD is proud of her compassion, dedication, and the difference that she continues to make for our community. So in the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing, not once, not twice, but four separate occasions. And then again, the life-saving and certainly life-helping actions of donating blood and plasma and platelets. Samantha Mattingly there with the Lynchburg, Virginia Police Department. We thank you for your many, many good deeds. All right, that's going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms Cam and Company. By the way, you know, I mentioned yesterday we're going to be talking with the Kosei Ono from the U.S. Virgin Islands gun owners. That's going to happen tomorrow, and that's my fault. I was a little confused as to when that interview was going to take place, so that will happen tomorrow. We'll have the latest on this sweeping gun control bill in the U.S. Virgin Islands that would, much like Duncan in the magazine ban in California, require existing owners of these so-called assault weapons to either modify their firearms, turn them over to police, or remove them from the Virgin Islands entirely. Supposedly, this bill is being rewritten. But we'll get the latest from Kosei Ono on tomorrow's Bearing Arms Cam and Company. Be sure to check out BearingArms.com throughout the day today, keeping you up to date on all of the latest Second Amendment news and information, including some major moves by Glock to discontinue most of its current production line. We've got that story for you. Not a rumor. That is based on what Glock is saying on its own website. Plus, we've got the latest legal, legislative, and regulatory news for you as well. The public comment period is closed on the DOJ's proposed rule on rights restoration. We've got the latest for you on that and much more. So check out BearingArms.com. If you like what you see, I'd encourage you to become a VIP, VIP Gold, or VIP Platinum member. Use the promo code POTUS47 and get 74% off your VIP membership. You can even join us for tomorrow's VIP Gold Live Chat with Hot Air's Ed Morris and myself at 1:30 Eastern. We do it every Wednesday. Love to see you there. Have a great rest of your 2A Tuesday. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Until then, be well, be safe, and be free.